This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The ups and downs of a flat tax on the broadcast today. What the Greeks see when they look in the mirror. And CEO to Saint, the Steve Jobs biography. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday, today the 25th of October. Great as always to have you with us. One can, without too much hard-looking, start to detect similar themes emerging as the Republican presidential campaign grinds on. Today was Texas Governor Rick Perry's turn. He gave a big speech about his economic plan down in South Carolina. The heart of the thing is an optional 20% flat income tax. And Perry's not the only flat tax in the mix. Herman Cain has his 999 plan, as you might have heard. And it all sounds simple enough, but Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports there will be some bumps along the way.
Flat tax proposals are nothing new. What's different with the Perry plan is people can choose the flat tax or not. And if they pick the flat tax, they still get to keep the deductions for their mortgage interest, state and local taxes, and charitable contributions. Perry says one attraction of the flat tax is its simplicity.
Central to my plan is giving every American the option of throwing out that 3 million words of the current tax code in order to pay a 20% flat tax on their income.
A 20% tax rate would be a big break for high-income earners who now pay 35% of their income to Uncle Sam. And 20% would be a tax increase for some low-income earners. That's the very definition of a regressive tax. But Kevin Hassett, a former advisor to Republican presidential candidates, says Perry's plan exempts $12,500 of income for every person who files.
If you have a large family, then you could have a significant amount of income before you pay any tax, which would mean that it would be a lot more progressive than you might think.
Another attraction of a flat tax is it rewards economic enterprise. University of Michigan economist Joel Slemrod says allowing entrepreneurs to keep more of their money means they have an incentive to earn more and invest in equipment or job creation, while the system we have now, he says, inhibits growth.
Whatever people do to earn more income, whether it be invested in education or work harder, a graduated tax system means the penalty, the tax penalty to that, goes up as you earn more income.
But a flat tax generates less revenue for the government. That's true for both Herman Cain's 999 plan and Perry's optional plan, which allows taxpayers to find the lowest tax rate available. And less revenue means cutting more government spending. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Here's today's Marketplace dictionary entry for the word oxymoronic. If you were to look it up, you'd see BP and good news. After the massive spill in the Gulf of Mexico last year, not many associate BP with anything good. But today, CEO Bob Dudley announced a turnaround and, as it happens, said profits have tripled since last year. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
The spill is so 18 months ago. That's how BP put it today, declaring $5 billion in quarterly profits and reaching what the company calls a turning point. Here's the thing. Analysts are buying it. Here's Fidel Gate at Oppenheimer.
This company proved how resilient oil companies are. Within 18 months, the company went from the brink of bankruptcy into one of the best, if not the best, offshore exploration company in the entire world.
For believers, the comeback story has a few chapters. A renewed focus on what BP does well, a new penitent CEO, and a smaller price tag on the spill. Several companies that partnered with BP in the Gulf have agreed to help pay the costs. Last week, Anadarko ponied up $4 billion.
These people came to the conclusion that was an accident caused by multiple parties and the oil share in the blame.
BP and partners still face 600 outstanding lawsuits, including a water pollution case that could cost up to $17 billion. Still, analyst Jack Plunkett says going forward, BP will be active in one of the most profitable areas, drilling in deep water.
Including, of course, the Gulf of Mexico, where they have huge lease holdings. They also have pretty exciting deals off the coast of South America. As you know, Brazil is now one of the most important and promising deep water reserves.
Just Friday, the U.S. government gave BP a green light to explore again in the Gulf. That's almost a year and a half to the day after the spill. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Once upon a time, there was a company called Netflix, and it did very, very well. Then it raised prices, and customers got angry. Then it tried to spin off its DVD-by-mail business, and customers got angrier. Almost a million walked away, and still, it got worse. The company said yesterday it could actually lose money for most of the next year. Or, to get more real about it, if you like, back in July, one share of Netflix stock sold for more than $300. At the close today, 77 simoleons. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports Netflix has been tying itself in knots, trying to play in the age of online streaming.
If you ask a media expert where TV is headed, you're likely to get a two-word answer: online streaming.
I think it is the future.
Ben Rose is a media analyst at Battle Road Research.
The only question is how long does the future take to unfold?
When you stream your shows online, you can watch what you want when you want it. You can catch NFL games on your Android. Rose says it's the way young people watch.
What's your favorite show?
My favorite TV show? I enjoy watching The Office.
And how do you watch it?
Through conventional TV.
Rose can see the future, but he's living in the past. He could watch The Office anytime. He can get it through an Xbox, watch on Hulu Plus, stream the British version on Netflix, or buy it on Amazon. Netflix began as a DVD rental business. Then it helped create the online streaming business. But today, online competition is intense, and it's just beginning. Max Dawson is an assistant professor of radio, TV, and movies at Northwestern.
The CEO of Netflix, Reed Hastings, has spoken out about his desire to not allow Netflix to get surpassed and left in the dust.
Amazon and Apple are after a piece of this market. So are the cable companies. Dawson says Reed Hastings is pushing his company toward the future faster than many of his customers want to move.
He's desperate to have Netflix not become AOL or MySpace or, I guess, Friendster or any of the other companies that kind of come along and establish something new and novel and then
get crushed. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
No fairy tale on Wall Street today. You can blame Europe. That's what I'd do. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Don't look now, but there are fresh problems with the Greek debt deal that was supposed to be worked out by, tomorrow. It's the same problem, actually, that there's been for months now. Exactly how big a loss banks are going to take on Greek debts that will likely never be paid back. Question is, didn't anybody see this coming? Didn't anybody in Greece or elsewhere realize that the status quo simply couldn't last? So following on to our jaunt out to Athens yesterday, Georgia, that is, we wanted to get a sense of how that question might be playing in Greece. Antonis Papianidis is the publisher of the Greek journal Economic Review, and we reached him at his home in the original Athens. Mr. Papianidis, good to have you with us.
Well, hello.
First of all, I guess your sense of how things are going in Greece today. What's the mood?
The mood is scared and scary at the same time. There is a wave of fear about things happening and things that are going to happen to us after the decisions of the European mechanisms trying to salvage something out of the Greek economy.
Let me ask you about that, actually, because one of the reasons we called is to try to get a sense of whether or not people realize that the model the Greeks had of good pensions and early retirement, whether they knew that that just wasn't sustainable in this economy.
No, people in Greece did not realize that the whole model of development that was followed in Greece, which was based on debt building up, was not sustainable. Greeks thought that we lived at the fringes of Europe with a moderate lifestyle that would be better and better year after year.
Do you expect, whether there's a final bailout or whether there's a default, do you expect any changes in Greek culture and in the attitude that people have?
Changes in culture do not occur easily, nor even abruptly. But also the political system of Greece, which is very much a Club Med mentality, they promise to their voters handouts and a rosy future. So they have to turn around and make themselves to stern disciplinarians.
Yeah.
It's not done within a generation of politicians.
Do you think, though, that the Greek people understand why Germany and France and others in the Eurozone are so questioning, I guess, about a bailout?
No, they don't really understand, because, in fact, we have been promised, Greece has been promised a solution, provided the Greek people would endure some pain. And then pain comes, and further pain is heaped upon the older pain, and nothing seems to have changed. So we feel betrayed both by our political system and by our allies and friends in Europe and by ourselves. But this last point is rather difficult to digest, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's a little bit like looking in the mirror and realizing you don't like what you see.
Yes, and if the mirror gets more and more warped as the time passes, you have also the tendency of saying that it's the mirror that is wrong and not yourself.
That's right. So let me ask you then, once you fix the mirror, assuming we can, and I say we because it becomes conceivably a global problem, then what happens?
Well, I think that we're going to have a hard landing followed by exiting the Eurozone, which will be quite a disaster both for Greece and for the Eurozone. And I don't really have very tender feelings about the Eurozone, but I do have quite tender feelings about my country.
Antonis Papianidis in Athens. He's the editor of Economic Review in Athens. Sir, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks indeed.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
I was at a big-time college football game this weekend. Had a lot of fun. It was a great game. But it really did bring home the fact that college sports are really big business. Hundreds of millions of dollars a year big business. The athletes who actually play the games, though, are largely left out of the profits. Even full-ride scholarships don't cover the real costs of college. So this week, the NCAA is going to start talking about how to fix things. Marketplace's Amy Scott has more now from the Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore.
The NCAA is looking at adding $2,000 to athletic scholarships and allowing schools to offer multi-year scholarships instead of one-year deals. Kenneth Shropshire directs the Wharton Sports Business Initiative at the University of Pennsylvania. He says one hope is that more money could help clean up college sports. Players have gotten in trouble recently for selling team memorabilia and accepting gifts.
The stories come every year, whether it's sports agents or boosters or even coaches, that money somehow has continued to kind of float around in this secret economy.
But some colleges say they can't afford to pay athletes more. Bob Kustra is president of Boise State University. He says most states are facing budget crises and cutting college funding.
Now doesn't seem to be the time to put any money on top of what is already a full ride for so many of the student athletes.
But college athletes say that full ride comes up about $3,000 short when you include costs like travel and laundry. Ramogi Huma is president of the National College Players Association. He says together, some of the big conferences make close to $800 million a year from TV deals.
College sports is not struggling. It's reflected in the coaches' salaries and bonuses and stadium expansions. But somehow, players are still being stuck with medical bills and losing their scholarships when they're injured, and it's just not genuine.
Boise State's Bob Kustra says the wealthy conferences will likely jump on the extra scholarship money, leaving the less well-off struggling to attract players. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up, what was it about Steve Jobs?
I think one reason may be his greatness as an artist who tried to connect art with technology.
But first, let's do the numbers. Bad at the start, worse at the close. The Dow Industrial sank 207 points today, 1.7%. Closed at 11,706. The NASDAQ tumbled 61 points, 2.25%. Finished at 2638. The S&P 500 lost 25 points. That's 2%, ended things at 1,229. As consumer confidence sank in the U.S., Post-it maker 3M said weak European consumer demand hurt earnings. The blue-chip shares fell off 6.25% today. United Parcel Service delivered good earnings, but a sober outlook. Its shares lost 2.1%. The swoon of the day went to Netflix. As we told you, the video rental company has faced a subscriber revolt over prices. Today, investors fled too. Netflix unspooled 35%. That's just today, not since everything started happening. News Corp surrendered nearly 3% after disclosing that more than a third of shareholders voted against re-electing Rupert Murdoch's son James to the board. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.11%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for September. The House Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution holds a hearing on the state of religious liberty in the United States. And happy birthday, Hillary Rodham Clinton. The 67th U.S. Secretary of State turns 64. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Tunisians are still waiting for the official vote count from this past weekend's election, the first real taste of democracy that country's had in decades. And as they start to grapple with the messy business of politics, there is the small matter of actual business to tend to, trying to get past the corruption and cronyism that had become the norm under now deposed President Ben Ali. Julia Simon reports the country's restaurants are gearing up for the challenge.
On the edge of the old walled city of Tunis, there's a restaurant that's so good it doesn't need its name on the door. Locals just know it. On the table are olives, pumpkin, and Tunisian harissa, full of spicy red peppers. English professor Munir Khalifa breaks off a piece of baguette for dipping.
People come sit, they are served, they eat, they leave. So someone else comes in.
It's fast food.
Yes, fast food a la Tunisienne.
Tunisians love their own traditional fast food, and as many Tunisians say with pride, there are no McDonald's here. One of Tunisia's few food chains is Baguette Baguette. The founder, Sofiane Khari, says some Tunisians see the lack of McDonald's as a cultural coup, but the real reason there are no foreign restaurants here goes back to Ben Ali's regime.
Back in 1996, there was a Tunisian who was going to open a McDonald's, but Ben Ali's son-in-law wanted to partner with him. And since he refused, Ben Ali decided that we don't need foreigners to make us sandwiches. It was an abuse of power by Ben Ali.
Khali says this abuse of power affected everyone in the Tunisian economy, him too.
Like in 2004, when we opened a stall in the airport, Ben Ali's son-in-law had it shut down because he had a competing stall there.
Zekri Noureddin is the general manager of the Foreign Investment Promotion Agency, part of the Ministry of Planning. He says that now that Ben Ali is gone, the corruption in the Tunisian economy has diminished.
After the revolution, transparency, good governance are being developed now. So I think that Tunisia now is more competitive, is more attractive than it was before the revolution.
And since January's revolution, many American companies have visited the country and are looking to invest. Gordon Gray is the U.S. ambassador to Tunisia.
There are a number of U.S. franchises, including in the food market, but others as well, that have told us they are looking at the market here in Tunisia. I think given the large middle class here and the familiarity with many of the famous U.S. franchises, that it would be a real opportunity for U.S. business.
And given Tunisia's high unemployment, Noureddin says he welcomes foreign business, especially because
foreign investment in Tunisia is creating up to 20 to 25% of jobs every year.
There are still Tunisians who say no merci to Mickey D, but 22-year-old English student Rania Makadam has a different view. She admits she'd be frustrated if U.S. chains dominated the Tunisian food scene. But even so, a cheeseburger now and again would be welcome.
I just like to, you know, pluralism in food even, not just in parties. This is democracy, right?
And for her, democracies all come down to the freedom of choice. In Tunis, I'm Julia Simon for Marketplace.
The night Steve Jobs died, we had a big meeting, trying to figure out what to say, how to cover it, but also trying to figure out how Jobs went from being a CEO of the world's best-known technology company to something closer to a saint. And that's when somebody mentioned this clip from The Simpsons.
Attention, Mapple universe. Prepare for a live announcement from Mapple founder and chief imaginative officer, Steve Mobs.
Steve Mobs!
He's a genius!
He's like a god who knows what we want!
Not too far off, right? So that's where I started with Walter Isaacson, who, as you probably heard by now, wrote the new Steve Jobs biography.
Well, it is pretty amazing that around the world, it was an outpouring that's usually reserved for rock stars or princesses. There's such an emotional connection with Apple and Apple products and with him. Mm. I think one reason may be not his greatness as a technologist or even his greatness as a business leader. It's his greatness as a designer and artist who tried to connect art with technology.
This is iMac. The whole thing is translucent. You can see into it. It's so cool. We got the coolest mouse on the planet right here. Got to see one of these things in person.
That, to me, is what gets people emotional, is the poetry. I don't want to wax too much on about it. I mean, I'll be, you know, sound like somebody, you know, who's fallen head over heels. But I did get captivated by that ability of Steve Jobs to intuitively, he knows how to make something emotionally connect with you and be beautiful.
The other part of him, though, that comes out in this book, and we should say at the outset, you pulled no punches, even though this was an authorized biography, is that he was, in your words, bratty. He was obstinate. He was profane. He was kind of a bully and a not a nice guy.
Well, he was definitely a bit bratty at times, that's for sure. But that's the price of admission for being in the room. He said, I don't know how to do it any other way. Maybe I could have worn velvet gloves, but that's not me. I'm a middle-class kid from California, and I demanded perfection. And on the very first machines they made, especially the original Macintosh in the early 1980s, Steve stops at one point and says, the circuit board isn't neat enough. The engineer said, but you can't even open the Macintosh. Nobody will see it. And Steve said, but you will know, and I will know. He made him sign the inside cover of the Macintosh, because he just wanted people to have that passion for artistry.
That's what a lot of customers pay us to do, is to try to make the best products we can. And if we succeed, they'll buy them.
This book has what you might call an unusual introduction. It's called How This Book Came to Be. And it, you relate how Jobs called you and wanted you to write a biography of him. This is in 2004 when, unbeknownst to you, he was just diagnosed with cancer. And you say, you know, he invited me out. We took a walk, and he said, write my bio. And you said, no, because I'm doing other things, and you've got a long time left to live. And then you say in the book, half-jokingly, you wondered whether he thought he was the successor to the people that you've written other biographies about, Einstein, Benjamin Franklin. Do you think he saw himself as that transformative?
No, I think he saw himself up with the great people who had created companies in Silicon Valley, including Hewlett and Packard and others. I think he could even see himself as an Edison or a Disney, somebody who connected creativity with great technology. But I think even Steve Jobs' most ardent fanboys wouldn't put him in the exact quantum orbit as Albert Einstein when it comes to relativity theory.
Entirely apart from being a biographer and having to maintain the detached eye, what'd you think of him just as a guy, as a man?
When I first met him in 1984, he was actually petulant back then. It was a Time magazine meeting, and he expressed dismay at an article at Time that he thought had been too rough on him. But even then, I liked him. And not only did I like him, I kind of got caught up by him. I mean, the passion is just a force of nature. And perhaps some will criticize it that I got a little bit caught up in that magical thinking of him. But you can't be totally objective when you're spending that much time with a person.
Walter, thanks a lot.
Hey, Kai, great to be with you.
People say you have to have a lot of passion for what you're doing, and it's totally true. And the reason is because it's so hard that if you don't, any rational person would give up. If you don't love it, you're going to fail.
We've got an excerpt of the new Steve Jobs biography on our website. It's marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, more trouble in solar. It's never good when a company thanks its CEO for his service in the same press release that announces he's stepping down. But that's exactly what happened today at First Solar, the country's biggest solar company. No comment other than Rob Gillette is, quote, no longer serving as CEO. We should say there is no whiff of impropriety. Could be as simple as this. Last time the company reported profits, earnings were down 62%. One more quick CEO thing before we go. This afternoon, IBM announced Virginia Rometty would be that company's first female CEO in its 100-year history, which, if my math is right, makes it 12 out of 500 Fortune 500 companies that are run by women. 12 out of 500. All right, that's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow sank 207 points, 1.7%. The NASDAQ tumbled 61 points, 2.25%. The S&P 500 lost 25 points, that is 2%. Thanks to Doug Krisner, Ethan Lindsay, and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Coming up next time back here, the answer to this question.
Why do Germans grudgingly reach into their pockets to bail out their dancing neighbors?
Also, the news of that meeting that's supposed to fix everything over there. I'm Kai Rizdal. I do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.